Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share my recent conversation with Mark Saylor. Mark is a graduate in our Executive MBA class of 2021, and he and I recently connected to talk about his MBA journey, his career story, what he's been up to since his graduation from Darden, and so much more. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's my interview with Mark Saylor. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brett. It's my pleasure. When you reached out to me and told me about the hundreds of thousands of emails you had got requesting for me to be on, I mean, I just couldn't say no.
You got to give the people what they want. And I think it's fair to say the people have spoken and they specifically requested this conversation.
Without further ado, let's get into it.
All right. Well, first and foremost, one of the zanier things about hosting this podcast is like, I'll go maybe a few years without seeing folks, certainly now with the pandemic. Normally, maybe our paths would cross for a reunion or something like that, but it's just the nature of the world we're in. We haven't seen each other in at least a couple of years, it feels like. How have you been? How are you doing?
Doing well. It's been a busy past few months. I really can't believe that graduation was less than a year ago. There's been a lot of change. We've changed states. My partner and I got engaged. It's been a busy time.
Wow. So much life to catch up on. I'm glad I invited you on the podcast. This is where I finally figure out what's been going on with Mark Saylor. What is he up to? Well, all right. So let's get into it. So we like to begin these conversations by setting the scene, so to speak. And so talking a bit more about who you are, your background, and kind of getting into your MBA journey. So tell us, who is Mark Saylor?
I mean, how much time do we have, Brett? I would say on a professional level, you know, I like to kind of brand myself as a people-focused problem solver. And from what that translates into in my career as a brand manager, it's really around identifying consumer need and then working with cross-functional teams to address those. I've had some really cool opportunities to do that across my career. I've worked with Toys R Us, Frank's Red Hot, Hot Sauce, Capital One. And then most recently, I am with a smaller independent organic poultry company based out of Harrisonburg, Virginia. I never saw myself in the organic poultry space, but it has been a really cool opportunity. The company is doing very well. It's called Farmer Focus. It is in Kroger, in Harris Teeter, in Publix, in Lidl. So just a quick plug, next time you're out at the store, check it out.
Wow. Okay. So that the company you're currently working for, it does seem like a little bit of a turn from what you were doing previously. How do you end up where you are now?
So I mentioned my previous role was at Capital One, which was a new industry for me, financial services. I didn't have much background in that. And it was a really interesting learning opportunity. One of the big takeaways for me was Capital One, I was on the Richmond campus, which was 10,000 people in and of itself. The full company is like over 40,000 people. And something that I kind of learned I was looking for that I was able to achieve with Farmer Focus is being on a smaller team and having the ability to make a stronger impact on the business. So when I joined Farmer Focus in summer of 2020, I was the third marketer with the company. So there was our CMO, there was another woman, Laura, who had been there for a few years, and then myself. So it was really cool and a pretty steep learning curve right up front to learn about the industry and the ins and outs, but then also just, again, this really awesome chance to dive in and to set up programs. And I built their customer marketing program. I built a relationship with IRI, who's a data syndicator. Really great opportunities like that to really kind of leave my mark on the business. And I've enjoyed that piece of it very much.
Well, that's awesome. Anybody who's driven up I-81, that is an agricultural hotbed, so to speak.
It is.
Drive north. I lived in Southwest Virginia for a number of years and clip along. It's a beautiful part of the country and quite a bit of agricultural business that takes place in that region.
Yeah, and it's really cool. So the mission of the company is to protect and promote generational family farms. And for me, my grandfather on my dad's side, he was a farmer, and it didn't get passed down past him. And part of the reason for that is it's just a really difficult career to sustain, to financially be able to support your family. So our founder is a sixth generational farmer. And we really pride ourselves. I mean, the brand is called Farmer Focus. We really pride ourselves in bringing that to life. One of the key ways we do that is every pack of chicken that we sell has a 4-digit farm ID, we call it, and it's fully traceable back to the farm that it was raised on. So you can enter that 4-digit farm ID on our website, and you can get pictures of the farm, meet the farmer and the family. So it's just a really cool business model, and glad to be a part of that.
This intersects with other conversations we've had here on the podcast around agribusiness and just how challenging it is to be a small farmer right now. The average age, I think it's come up previously when we talked about this, the average age of a farmer, like a small farmer in the U.S. is north of 60. So it's quite old. And there's this real kind of succession challenge. As you noted, like who is interested in taking over the family farm? I think about conversations that we've had recently with Will Payne, who is doing a lot of work in Southwest Virginia on trying to transform that economy and how do you make people's cropland more profitable for them to ultimately make their business more sustainable. So it feels like a very timely issue. It also feels very, very local to a state like the Commonwealth of Virginia that has a large agricultural base.
Yeah, we have over 70 independent family farms that we partner with, and they're all in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia and West Virginia. And the way that our business model is structured, not to get too much in the weeds, but we are able to pay our farmers about like a 30 to 35% premium over what traditional growers pay. I think it's a really interesting benefit. And again, it just kind of goes back to supporting the mission of being able to support farming as a generational occupation. And we see new farmers coming on like in their 30s, and it's really cool being able to have a farmer like with gauges in their ears, right? It's like not what you traditionally think of within the farming industry, but it's how we see the future. So very excited for that.
All right. And for our listeners who are curious about this topic, I'd also recommend another conversation we recorded with an executive MBA program alum, Hunter Hopcroft, talking about sort of the financial end of things and how do you help support people through loans and sort of instruments of finance in this kind of small farm agribusiness space. So, Mark, I want to talk a little bit more about your MBA journey. That's one of the conversations we really get into here on the podcast, and curious about how you got interested in pursuing an MBA.
Sure. So I actually always wanted an MBA. And fun fact is I started one over 10 years ago, and it was just not the right time for me. So I guess a little bit of background is I graduated my undergrad right in the middle of like the 2008 financial crisis. My first role was with Linens and Things, if you remember them. They were a home retailer like a Bed Bath & Beyond. And I remember that I got my job offer in April, and I started in May. And then by October, November, they had filed for Chapter 11 and they were closed. And it was like kind of my first foray into corporate America and like, what do I do now? And again, being in the middle of this global financial crisis, it was a tough job market. So I ended up actually going back to school. At that time, I was interested, but I wasn't really passionate about it. Like I really wanted to be working. I had just finished my undergrad and wanted to be out there applying these skills. So I did school for a couple months, and then I found a great opportunity on the career side with a toy company called Kinex. They're based out of Pennsylvania. They're a construction toy, kind of like Erector Sets, but in plastics. And then I stopped doing the MBA, went to work for Kinex, and then that set me up for career growth with Toys R Us and beyond. So I guess fast forwarding then to 2018, I found myself in a similar situation. I had been with Frank's Red Hot. Frank's Red Hot, the company was sold off, and I took a severance package coming out of that, and kind of looked around and said, okay, what do I want to do? At the same time, my partner Ian, he was in the middle of a career change and had been applying to law schools, and ultimately we decided that the best school for him was UVA, so we moved down to Charlottesville in 2018. And truly, Darden had not been on my radar, and we got here and I applied for a couple jobs and was like, I think now is the time. This is the universe saying like, you should go back to school. So I applied to Darden full time. And about a week, I think it was about a week to the day after I submitted my full-time application, I got a call from Capital One. And they said, hey, remember that job that you applied 4 or 5 months ago? Do you still want that? And I said, sure. And then I emailed you and I changed my application from full-time to EMBA. And here we are.
The rest, as they say, is history. Now, that is a big shift to think about taking 2 years off and being a full-time residential student to thinking about working while pursuing your degree. It sounds like you made that shift pretty quickly. Like you had this opportunity at Capital One and you're like, great, I'll do this and work while pursuing my MBA.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I'm personally a little bit more risk averse in some ways. So if I can keep a steady income coming in while I'm doing school, that's kind of my personal preference. I also knew that traditionally people leverage full-time programs to make a more dramatic career shift. And that really wasn't what I was looking to do. I was just looking to kind of expand my education and you know, both in my concentration, but then in just kind of broader kind of enterprise concentrations. And that's what I felt the EMBA program could best give me to support my career growth.
All right. So you come to the executive MBA program. You have the prior experience of having started another MBA program. And so in some ways, maybe you're a little bit more familiar with what an MBA could look like. But Darden is a bit different than other MBA programs. What was that first few months, first semester, first year like for you?
It was very challenging. I remember in LR1, which is like your first week of your executive MBA program, they bring the whole class together in Charlottesville. And our very, very first case that I ever sat through was called Safaricom. And it was a telecommunications / fintech case based in Kenya. And I in the middle of that case, I was looking around the classroom like, what am I doing here? Like, this is insane. I know nothing about this. It was a great case. And that happens, you know, throughout the first year. It's like, wow, this is a lot. And I think there's a little bit of Darden almost trying to intimidate you up front, you know, trying to scare you straight. Like, okay, if you're signing up for this, like, this is what you get. But no, it was a great experience. I think the biggest thing for me was learning how to learn, because I had been out of school for over 10 years. And some people learn in a more collaborative way. Some people learn, they want to be isolated to do that, right? So it's kind of finding out what best works for you. And one of the tricky parts for me is you're on a learning team, which is an incredible advantage, because the learning teams are comprised of people with different backgrounds. So exploring these cases, which again may not be your particular area of expertise, you have people around you who are able to support you, which is great. But then again, it is also navigating that dynamic of, okay, well, maybe the person who's like really great in finance is also more of like an introspective learner, but like I want to be in a group setting. So how do you kind of figure that out? There's a couple things to navigate as you're coming on. But I think for me, it's realizing that everyone in the program, professors, students, like truly, truly has your best interest at heart. Like it very much is a community feel, which was awesome. So my learning team ended up kind of merging with another learning team, which was great for both supporting the learning process, but also just getting to meet new people. And there was a couple times where I would reach out to professors kind of outside of class and they would help me with some things. So yeah, I think it's, don't be afraid to ask for help and again, kind of be confident in what you need and people will support you in that.
Well, Mark, I appreciate your talking about the first week of school, because having been around kind of a neutral observer, so to speak, like I'm invested, but I'm not necessarily involved like the students are in that first week. And I can tell that students are sometimes feeling a little overwhelmed, and you read some tough cases sometimes. I mean, that Safaricom case is really long. It's an enterprise case. There's a lot going on in that case. It's also the case that in the first week, you're in a classroom full of people and you're trying to figure each other out, right? There's some folks who already have a lot of background in some of these areas, and they may participate and share things in class that you never even heard about before. And they seem to speak about it so confidently. And, you know, that can get people out of their comfort zone, because that that's not typically your prior experience and other educational experiences. And so at first we just try to remind people to breathe and recognize that, like, you're just learning. You're getting used to things. And this is all part of a process, but it can be a lot for people up front.
Absolutely. And I would just add to that, that there will be a moment in the program where that script will be flipped. Like for me as a marketer, we don't take marketing until I think Q7. But I mean, once we got there, like there, people in the class would look to me and be like, I don't know, what did we do? What did we say? So it definitely works both ways. So I would just say, like, if you're in a finance or an econ class and that's not, again, your historical perspective, and it seems like, wow, people really know what they're talking about, like, again, that will be you in a couple months. So wait for that.
Your time is coming. What was that like to be in one of those marketing classes with your classmates and recognizing that you have a lot of expertise to share there?
It was very empowering. And it actually happened, the first time I felt empowered, if you will, was actually not in a marketing class. It was in finance. It was Q3, and it was Professor Conroy, and we did a class on Crest white strips. So my career is within the CPG sector, which I think was perhaps like less represented in my classmates and their experience, but not a lot of people knew about CPG and how that operates. So we had this case on Crest white strips. You know, P&G is the classic CPG brand. And the case was really about, they were looking to make an innovation in this product, and you as a financial analyst, like, what would you recommend? And spoiler alert, the professors, they all get kind of like your resume, like a dossier about all the students before class, so they know like you and your background. So we had this really rich discussion around the financial impacts of this product launch. And then at the end of it, Professor Conroy turned to me and like cold called me. And he was like, you're in brand management, what would you do? And I remember like I obviously incorporated the financial analysis into my answer, but I also included a lot about competitive threats and brand reputation and impacts on the future of development and retail relationships and things like that, that just I knew about from my professional experience. And it was a really cool moment because Professor Conroy got to explain to the class that in a company like P&G, finance is actually more of a support function for marketing. Like marketing are the ones who are calling the shots, and finance is helping to validate the profitability of that strategy. Whereas I feel like perhaps historically, a lot of my classmates saw it the opposite way, that kind of financial or analyst roles or consultants were leading the strategy and marketing was supporting it. So it was just a cool moment for people to realize like, oh, this works differently in different industries. And like marketers can have, you know, a business leading perspective. So I think it first started there. But to get back to your original question, yes, when we got into marketing classes as well, it was really cool. And Kim Whitler, she taught our marketing 2 class, and she was a residential professor, and this was her first time teaching EMBA. And it was really neat because she reached out to me prior to the class and said, hey, I heard that, you know, you're one of the marketers in the program, and I would love to touch base with you on the curriculum for the Marketing 2 class and what, like, you know your classmates better than I do, what's going to be most valuable to them, what can they apply in their careers every day. So I think that was just a really cool experience as well, being able to work with her and really shape how the marketing cases came together and what the class would be able to glean from that.
Well, I had no idea that you had a hand in the Marketing 2 curriculum. That's pretty cool.
I only did if people appreciated it. If not, it was all Kim.
Well, Mark, curious about why Darden for you? It sounds like maybe proximity and these kinds of things, but there are other programs around. What about Darden appealed to you and resonated with you as you thought about where you wanted to pursue your MBA?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of it, I did apply to other programs. When we moved to Charlottesville, I truly didn't know much about Darden. And I started researching it, and I was so impressed by, I mean, just the stats about the school, right? Like number one faculty, number one educational experience. So, I mean, that was incredible. And then Ian had already at that point, he was in his first year at UVA Law. So he was able to speak to me a little bit about kind of UVA cultural UVA culture holistically and what that meant. I had my cousin, one of her best friends had recently graduated from Darden. So she had introduced me to him and he was great. And we had at least two or three phone calls where he talked to me about the program. So I think there was a pretty clear sense of the community at Darden. So I think that was just a huge, huge thing for me. Also that the case method is really interesting. Not a ton of schools offer it. And kind of the education that I knew that I wanted, where you really get the benefit of multiple perspectives. The professors are great and they guide that discussion, I mean, expertly, but they really do a fantastic job of incorporating different classmates' experience, making sure that everyone is involved. And that's, for me, where some of the best learnings came from, is hearing about how these different practices are applied in everyday life.
Well, I appreciate that. What was it like for you to be in an MBA program while your partner was in law school? Parallel lives, although the JD program is more a residential program, so yes. a little different path.
It is. I always tell people, like, listen, Ian only had to do law school. I had to do my MBA and work full time. So really, I mean, come on. No, but in some ways, it was almost beneficial that we were both in school because we both understood the time commitment. Ian would have class all day. I would have work all day. We would both do homework at night. So it wasn't that I was like, oh man, like I feel like lonely because he's doing work, and we were both kind of in it together. So that was almost a benefit. I'm also, I think, as maybe most MBA candidates are, like a type A planner. So I was like all over our Google Calendar with like, okay, this night is going to be date night, or this night we're having, you know, friends over. And actually that piece for me was really helpful. We had friends come to visit from out of state for a weekend. And I really appreciated that because it helps me, if I know, like, okay, I have this weekend scheduled off for friends coming, like that helps me plan, like, okay, well, I need to get then this case done this day and this day. So it wasn't so much a sacrifice of like, okay, well, I don't get to have a social life for 2 years. It's just, again, being hyper-vigilant about if I'm going to do this and I need, what's the trade-off? And I need to, you know, again, plan and get my exams done early or get this case done early. But yeah, I think it worked out really well for the two of us that it kind of happened. And then what was, I guess, one of the silver linings of our graduation program, the way that it kind of fell apart with COVID, is the law school and the MBA program got to graduate together. So we actually, Ian and I then got to be at each other's graduation programs, which was like a really, I think, a cool thing. So.
Well, that is really cool. And I appreciate your noting how you managed your time. It's something that we talk with podcast guests quite a bit about, because in my experience, people are already pretty organized. They become even more organized in this program.
Absolutely.
Things that maybe previously wouldn't have been on a schedule are now on a schedule because it helps plan. It helps people in your life know that you have things coming up, or your learning team know that you're not available on this evening or this weekend. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the learning team, because that was something, you know, when you're getting into the program and you're trying to figure out the interpersonal dynamics, I think it's a little bit of, you don't want to let people down, right? But I think for me, it's about kind of opening clear communication. And there were plenty of times with my learning team, people had conflict, either professional or personal. And I know I never felt like let down by them. It's like, yeah, you have a life, you need to lead that. So I think it's just about communicating to people, hey, I'm available here, I'm not available here. And if you're not available, you know, contribute via email. There are other ways to collaborate. It doesn't always have to be in person at this time. But yeah, again, for Ian and I, we use Google Calendar. That was a big thing. Mine is color-coded. It's a little overwhelming. But yeah, just being able to talk to your friends, your family, and setting expectations. And that was a big thing for me, is you want to be available, but I also think you need to almost be, not defensive, but like protective of your time and your energy, right? And I think that's a difficult dynamic to figure out, because at the end of the day, that's like your most valuable resource, is your time and your energy. So I think it's okay to say no to people, because you know you need to put yourself first to some effect. It is a community, but the community only thrives if the individual members are thriving. So I would just encourage people to set boundaries. People in your life love you and they respect that. And at the end of the day, that's gonna be the best for you and for them.
Well, there's so much goodness in what you just shared, because I feel like that's a journey for every executive MBA student. And in terms of the learning team, that dynamic, how team members hold each other accountable, how you decide to work together, it takes a little while to iron that out. And we do see, you know, some teams stay together, some teams, you know, reform with other teams or combine in the case of your learning team with another learning team. But in my experience, most executive MBA students are working with other students to navigate the program. There's a fair amount to do, and you have a limited amount of time. And why not pool your expertise, wisdom, and resources?
Yeah, and I really appreciated quarter to quarter how the students are mixed up between classes. So you're never with like the same group every time. So you really get to meet other people. You know, experience different points of view, and then to your point, you can connect with those people offline, make great relationships you can take into future quarters. So your network will continue to grow and evolve quarter to quarter.
All right. Well, let's talk about, you know, where you are right now, and come back to where we started this conversation. Yeah. With the work that you're doing. Obviously, it sounds like you're with a smaller mission-driven company. What's exciting to you about where this company is going and what you're looking forward to in the months to come?
We're very fortunate in that the brand has had a phenomenal growth trajectory just in the past couple of years. I mean, we're currently the fastest growing chicken brand in the country. And that's not just organic chicken, that's like any chicken brand, right? So that's an incredible accomplishment. In the organic space, we're the second largest organic chicken brand in U.S. grocery. So it's, and this was not the case when I joined the company, you know, 2 years ago. So just incredible credit to the team in sales and operations and finance and marketing for bringing this together. It's been such an incredible ride. And it truly comes back to the more accounts we can bring on, the more product we can sell. It's good for the business, but it's good for the farmer. And that's what we really true back to, is when we sign a new account, we say, thank you for helping us support farmers, right? And it's such a cool thing. So again, when I started in the summer, I think our one kind of national account was Publix. And then we signed Kroger, and then we signed Harris Teeter. We're in Giant Eagle. And we're at the point now where, as we look toward our future, there's a couple different strategies we're exploring. One is, hey, we have this core product. We can try to continue selling that to more people. And that's more of a distribution play. The other half of that is, hey, we have a great fan base and we have a great network of retailers. And what can we do on the innovation side to make new products that are going to reach those consumers and allow us to expand in that way? So that's kind of part of what my role encompasses, is brand innovation, new product development. So I do a lot of consumer research, market trends, understand really where the organic food space is going, the natural food space is going. And then we work with our R&D team and our operations team to then make that product happen and get it onto shelves. So really excited. We've had some pretty significant CapEx investments in the past couple months, and excited to see where that takes us.
What do you attribute this growth to? Like evolving sort of tastes of consumers, just people more interested in knowing where their food comes from? I'm curious. Like, it sounds like y'all are really on an incredible ride here, and y'all must have some sense of where all this is coming from.
Absolutely. A part of it came from COVID, actually. There was a big shift on consumer health trends, and to your point, being more aware of what you're putting into your body. So I would say kind of organic and natural saw a pretty significant lift coming off of that. The other piece of COVID was like restaurants shut down, right? So people were kind of forced to be at-home cooks overnight. So we saw a really significant increase. I mean, I'm sure everyone listening experienced out of stocks, or I mean, still happening, right? at shelf and in grocery. So, I mean, that was a big thing, that we just got our product into more and more consumers' hands. And I think people, once they do try organic product, they do notice a difference, right? It does taste different. It does cook different. And I think that's proving out kind of our mission and our values. And it's like, yes, it's good for the farmer. It's a sustainable play. Our product is certified humane. So there's this kind of value-based purchasing that happens, but then it has to taste good, right? And it does. So I think it's kind of a perfect storm of those factors that is leading this kind of cultural shift in organic purchasing.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about the opportunities, for a food related company in COVID, people cooking at home and kind of thinking more health conscious and things. Because I feel like for a lot of agribusiness, a lot of the conversations for the past few years has been around supply chain disruption and headwinds and challenges and things like that. Has that been part of your company's story too, or y'all had to navigate those same issues?
Absolutely. It's a bit of a different. So supply chain for us is a little bit different because our product is the chicken, right? So for us, we're in a bit of a supply crunch right now, which has to do with forecasting. And if we need more product, we can't just kind of send in an order, right? It's you have to, there's a certain amount of lead time to raise birds. So I think that's part of it. But then there's also, you talk about supply chain and rising costs and commodities. I mean, like our feed costs have increased exponentially. Our shipping costs have increased exponentially. So there's definitely a lot of those factors that we have to consider. But as part of that, we just opened a new plant late last year. So we're looking to onboard a number of new farms. I think it's somewhere around 20 to 30 new farms this year and then beyond to help meet that demand. So it's an exciting place, but yes, there is a supply crunch, definitely.
Yeah, I appreciate you're noting some of the material related costs, right? Feed, and of course, it feels like you got to get these things to market. So gas and some of the commodity prices, I'm sure, ultimately show up on your bottom line at some point. Just feels like these are threads that have continued to ripple here over the past few years.
Definitely.
Well, I'm thinking about your work as a marketer, and it must be really, really interesting to be able to tell this, like, this is your farmer who brought you this chicken story, and to bring that kind of personal dimension to, I will admit, as a food consumer, it can kind of seem a little impersonal. We can feel really removed from where our food is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've had this 4-digit farm ID on our packs for a number of years. But one of the other kind of silver linings of COVID for us was the rebirth of the QR code. It was, you know, very much on a downward trajectory, and then all of a sudden it exploded in COVID times. So we're actually, we did some research last year and have revamped our packaging now to include this QR code to make it even easier for consumers to be able to go on that traceability journey. So just scan the QR code on pack. It takes you to the website where you can, again, browse through those farms, meet the farmer. And it is a really cool thing. We have, you know, farmer ambassadors that we can bring with us to trade shows. We just released a new marketing campaign, the first of this year, called Making Organic Mean More, which is really focused on organic itself is a great thing, but we believe that there are still opportunities beyond that. So I mentioned like the certified humane aspect, sustainability, and there are things that we do and certs that we carry that are not mandated by organic. So for us, it's telling this farmer story. We have one farmer, Jason, who when the nights get really cold, as they have been lately, he stays up in the barn with the chicks all night to make sure that like they stay warm, right? And it's this extra bit of care that is so incredible to see their devotion to the animals and how they're raised, that we definitely want to share that with the consumers and help them understand who the people are behind this product. And again, just all the true love that goes into it.
And I imagine you can see if people are interested in that content. Are people curious? Do they use those QR codes? Do they follow up on the stories?
Absolutely. We've had, I think last year it was almost 100,000 people who kind of went to the FarmID website to go meet their farmer. It's been great consumer reaction. We get some wonderful social media comments or people who write in or call in to thank us for how we're conducting our business, and they love, again, being able to see the farmer and learn more about them. So yeah, it's been really beneficial for all the different stakeholders.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking about is I'm curious how your time at Darden shaped your interest in this company, this opportunity. You talked about the sort of career interest of moving from a really large organization to a smaller one where you could have more impact. But did your time at Darden play a role in terms of shaping your interest here?
It definitely did. For me, I mean, there were a number of great takeaways from Darden, but if I had to kind of sum it up, it was kind of around this idea of confidence, and that happened in a few different ways. So for me, when we talk about like finance or accounting or areas that I haven't historically had a huge training in or a huge professional experience in, kind of Darden gave me that vocabulary that I work incredibly cross-functionally every day. So now I just feel much more confident when I talk to my coworkers in those departments. We've been doing a lot, like I think I mentioned, with CapEx requests for PP&E. And so I can, again, talk that talk with our finance team, or even things like I set up a couponing program last year, right? And I had to talk to accounting about budget accruals for couponing. And so I think it's just a way that I feel like I can now carry myself and talk to those departments and kind of gain credibility with them, which has been incredibly helpful. And then on the marketing side, it's been very helpful in two different ways. I would say one is learning about new kind of technologies or processes in marketing that I hadn't had previous exposure to. So one of the classes that I took in Q9 was a MarTech class with Raj. And it was really interesting because the whole class was structured around bringing in speakers, professional industry leaders, right, to speak to the class about their products. So we had Vic Fatnani, who was the co-founder of AdLingo at Google. He spoke to us about the software, which is really cool. It's basically at a very basic level, like banner ads, but they're embedded with a chat bot. So consumers can actually like interact and like talk to the banner ads and like get their questions answered, things like that. So that's like a really interesting technology that we could implement in our program. We also had Heather Freeland, who's the head of marketing at Lyft. She spoke to us about customer retention. So a lot of just interesting like practical strategies and applications that I can bring back to my company. But on the other side too, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but the program really reinforced in me that I have more subject matter expertise than I thought. Right. And when I had the Kim example earlier, like she asked me like, hey, how can we set up this program to be most beneficial to your classmates? One of the EMBA alums, Melissa Stefaniak, she spoke to us one night about entrepreneurship, and she founded a company called Single Bake Sweets. And I reached out to her after the class, and we had an hour-long conversation. She wanted kind of my perspective on branding and marketing best practices. So it's things like that you're like, wow, no, I do know what I'm talking about. Like I really can contribute. And that to me has been incredibly impactful in the way that I kind of conduct myself at work and realizing my worth and the value of my experience and what I bring to the conversation. So I would say all of those pieces are kind of how Darden has helped support me in my career.
Well, thank you for sharing all of that, Mark. And Melissa is a friend of the podcast. We had her on, gosh, a few years ago. Have we been on this long? A few years ago to talk about Single Bake Sweets, yeah. Which is someone who does not have all the baking implements, really does appeal, right? You don't have to go and spend like a fortune if you just want to make yourself a cupcake, you know?
Yeah, so no, it's a really cool program. And I have to imagine, I mean, I haven't spoken to her in a little bit, but I have to imagine the past couple of years have been, I would say, really impactful for her and her business, being able to, given that people, again, were kind of stuck inside, wanted more experience with baking, with cooking, and they could order these individual kits that has everything you need. You just kind of do a quick mix, throw it in the oven. I mean, you have a delicious dessert. So yeah, excited to see where that business goes for her.
As you noted, cooking has gone through a renaissance, and baking as well. I think we all remember the sourdough movement too from What a time it has been, Mark, to say the least. And so we ask our guests here on the podcast the same last question. And I wonder, what's a piece of advice you would share with our prospective student listeners, something you would encourage them to think about?
Sure. So I have a couple, if that's okay. I promise I'll try to keep them succinct. But the first, and this I didn't really realize until maybe halfway through the program or so, is that you as a student have the power to change the program. Like it's not a static thing. You have an impact on your education. And I think that's incredibly valuable to understand going in. So, you know, beyond just kind of me and the marketing curriculum, we had so many students who directly impacted opportunities both in and out of the classroom in our cohort. So we had like Nicole Vige and Daniel Roberts. They set up a consulting club for the Emma class, right? And out of that consulting club, I mean, multiple people were able to network and get jobs. I know Nicole's at McKinsey now. Like that wasn't something that existed, but you have the power to do that. We were in school beyond just living through COVID. You know, we were in school when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were killed, and we had Mike and Aja and the rest of like the Bemba group that was pushing us for so much necessary change in our cohort. I mean, they set up town halls to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and what that meant. They even impacted the curriculum as well. We had an elective coming out around DEI that was not previously scheduled. So like that was an incredible thing. Robert and Aaron and I put together a Pride celebration to not only talk about the history of Pride, but like inclusion in the workplace. And we worked with Christy Julian on that. So there's just so many resources that you can actually really affect the learning experience. It's not just kind of dart in like a cookie cutter thing. Like you can really impact that. So that'd be kind of number one, is to take an active role. And then number two for me, and this is also something I kind of learned over the program, is there's no like right or wrong way to do an MBA. And I think that's important because I felt, okay, I'm coming into this program and I need to check all these boxes to get the most out of this program for me. And I don't know, if you're like an accountant and you want to come in and you want to diversify and learn about marketing and entrepreneurship and real estate, like that's great. If you're a marketer and you want to come in and like specialize in marketing, like that's great too. If you want to go out on Friday nights and stay out till 3 a.m., good on you. If you want to go to bed early, like great. And there's no right or wrong. Like it's about you and it's about what's best for you. And just feeling confident in that, I think is a cool thing. And I would say just like the caveat is like, yes, do whatever is best for you, but just kind of stay open to the possibility of what is out there. Like there were times that I pushed myself and went to programs that I wouldn't normally gone to. I took electives that like I didn't think I would like, but ended up loving. One of my best friends coming out of this program, he and I have pretty different political beliefs. And I think going into the program, I was like, I want to surround myself with people who feel the same as I do. And I mean, meeting him, like, I don't know, I just feel like we both make each other better people. And I'm so glad that we know each other. And I think it's going to be like a lifelong friendship for sure. So I guess there's that piece. Yeah, like do what's best for you, but just stay open to the possibility of other things. And when the time is right, push yourself and explore. It's a very fulfilling experience.
Well, Mark, I love that point around openness. I think that oftentimes when we meet prospective students, they feel like they have to have everything decided and made up. And, you know, of course, we ask them questions through the application process. Yes, we want to know where you think you'd like to go in terms of a career goal and how an MBA can fit into those plans. But I think most people in the program would tell you there's this element of serendipity. There's the surprises that happen along the way in the best sense of that word, things that you did not anticipate and yet have so enriched your program experience. And so staying open to that, recognizing that's part of the journey here at Darden is important. So it's been such a pleasure catching up with you and hearing about the work that you're doing. What an exciting time for you and your company.
This has been great. Thank you so much for having me on. And I look forward to making this a monthly affair.
I would very much enjoy that, Mark. And you know what? Maybe our listeners would too. So thank you again and take care.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Mark Saylor, a graduate in our executive MBA class of 2021. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's E-X-E-C, MBA, at darden.virginia.edu. Till next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.